Welcome to Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Zena Stain. Zena Stain joined the Columbia University School of Public Health in 1966 after completing medical school in South Africa and psychiatry training in the United Kingdom. While her original work focused on mental retardation, she is best known as one of the founders of perinatal epidemiology and for her pioneering work on the effects of the HIV epidemic on women's health. I conducted this interview with Zena in 2002.
Zena, thank you for agreeing to participate in this. Starting at the beginning, most epidemiologists have never heard of epidemiology when they're growing up. Most people who enter the field probably even finish university without knowing about that there is such a thing as epidemiology. So I'd like to hear you talk about how you ended up in epidemiology, what you started out thinking you were going to do, and how you ended up where you did.
Well, I have to start with my youth growing up in South Africa. And I suppose it's not coincidental that you'll find a lot of South African people, medically qualified of my generation, who ended up in epidemiology. And I think it's because the scene in which we grew up was, there were two separate societies in a way, poor black, middle class and wealthy whites. And mostly the medical schools were, and universities were the whites. And so it was a good situation to learn and think if you had a social conscience of any kind. And then there was the war, World War II, for those who don't remember when it happened. And that was also a very stirring, a very stimulating, if you like, a very stirring experience. And so one, by the end of World War II, one really knew one had to go somewhere, work in some context which would make a difference to the society. And so we took up medicine with the image in mind that medicine was the way in which we could do something, if you like, for the poorer populations. Before I did medicine, I was a history student before I entered into the military capacity. And history was, I was drawn to history and enjoyed it. And sometimes I look back at my career and I think I may as well have done history as done epidemiology. But when I, after the war, both Mervyn and I went into medicine with, I think, quite a strong feeling that medicine was a way to make some impact on the inequalities and injustices of the society we knew. And we were lucky enough to meet others who were similarly influenced by these motivations. At the period, which was we were the students, 1945, 1946, 1947, and this was a period of stirring among South Africans. There were various commissions to illustrate the poverty and of the cities, even if we couldn't see them, and starvation, nutrition. These were really obvious in front of us. And although the formal training of medicine that we underwent had almost nothing to do with that, still we could feel at the periphery that these were ways we could go. I mean, you'd have been amazed that, for instance, we had pediatrics, and the course we had in pediatrics was very small, I think two lectures, and they concentrated on a disease which nobody in South Africa and Africa would ever have had. And if we read outside our subject, we took 19th century European books which told about the poverty and the starvation of the children in Bavaria or somewhere. And the mismatch between our students and the formal lectures and what we knew was happening elsewhere was, I think, when I look back, a very stimulating experience, because we knew there was something wrong and we'd have to go beyond it. and we met by fortune and by knowing colleagues as students. We met quite soon. We met Dr. Sidney Clark, who's very famous in the field of public health, and he was the one who most explained to us how your work as a doctor could in fact do something to the society, something promotive was his word. We used to have preventive medicine and curative medicine, but he had a new word, promotive, which meant you actually made a difference to your to the community you worked, and you'd need both the preventive medicine information you could wean from anywhere and the regular treatment qualities you need to learn. It's very good because it made us aware right from the beginning at medical school how to use the information that was being purveyed to us and how to think actively, because the teaching wasn't there. And so we had quite a lot of societies, small societies and little study groups outside medical school, which brought us into a field which we later on came to recognize as epidemiology. It wasn't on the syllabus. Something on the syllabus was called public health, which was all students found it very boring. And unfortunately, they are lovely words, public health. I've myself felt sad that we found that subject so boring, and it was nearer to engineering, sanitation, than it was about people. Although if you read the smaller print, it had relevant facts that you needed for a community practice. It had, in our time, nothing of what we might see as epidemiology. So as students tend to revolt against what they are taught, if you like to take that as a principle, we revolted against what we were taught and learnt outside the medical school. And people used to say, I learnt my trade and the vocations from Eton and Harrow, if you like. So we learnt a lot in the time off the strict medical school by going around it. And I think that's how we came to understand what active public health could do when allied with treatment. Not the word epidemiology.
Mm-hmm.
Epidemic, yes, like everybody else, but not epidemiology until later on.
So, you know, one of the things that strikes me as you tell this story is that you describe socially active physicians who are drawn to do something about health inequities. But where in that formula did the intellectual rigor of epidemiology, that we think of epidemiology today,
right,
come to play? Because that wouldn't
right.
necessarily be there.
No. I really don't know the exact answer. We had two or three influences on us. We had two people at Witwatersrand Medical School. We had a very strong, thoughtful basic science physiology group, Joe and Teddy Gilman, and many of the students in our year, intelligent students, were drawn to work with them, including some who were very famous, like Sidney Brenner and Philip Tobias, who were extremely scientifically alert and friends of ours. And so that, in a way, they pushed us to think if in our own field, if we want scientifically, if you like. Epidemiologists, I can only Sidney Clark himself had quite a lot of that in his own writings and makeup, but it was not exactly the way we went, although he valued this kind of thinking. He didn't, I would say, he didn't contribute much to what, certainly to me. I won't talk about Mervyn here, but we did have an idea that science was important in our work.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Of course, we talked to each other, which is also important.
In some ways, it sounds like you almost created your own model.
Well, I think we did, but we still tried to do it in the field of health in South Africa. We never thought we'd move.
Mm-hmm.
We never thought we'd leave those problems alone. It was regarded as unpatriotic even to think of that. But we thought we'd do this particular thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as events transpired, you ended up being in the UK and then the US.
Yes.
And at what point did you stop doing clinical work, and did your self-identity evolved to something else?
When I came here, when I came to the States, even in UK, I had clinical roles, and I didn't really see the difference. Although most of my work then evolved into epidemiology, I could still play a role clinically. When I came here, you had to register to become a physician, and I thought that wasn't worth it. I wasn't doing sufficient amount of clinical work. My thinking was more in the field of epidemiology. But in England, I did a residency in psychiatry, as I was telling you earlier, which I really enjoyed. And also the work we did with mentally retarded populations was also included a clinical role. Though I think it was, and I also did residency, I did jobs every now and then at a hospital, general hospital, but it's not where my intellectual interests were there.
And so at what point would you say you identified yourself as an epidemiologist rather than a clinician?
I think when I was in England, but I didn't see it as so separate from my work in clinical work. Mm-hmm. I saw the two together. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we came here, when I entered schools of public health, that I could see they were diverging. They were divergent. I always thought that schools of public health ought to be closely in medical schools, and it took time to move around here to see that there were advantages to have the schools of public health independent. But I was pleased to be at Columbia, where we had the two disciplines closely together. I thought that an epidemiologist ought to understand health and would do it better where we were training physicians.
So about what are the dates when you were
We came here, and we came in 1965-6.
Okay.
We left South Africa in 19. We qualified in 1950, and left in 1956, and spent a decade in Manchester, a year in London, and the rest of the time Manchester. But in that time, we went on a small 6-month trip to India, to Kanpur, where Mervyn was a visiting professor. Mm-hmm. And that was very rewarding too, to see what life was like in India. And so we'd had the South African experience and the Indian experience and the British experience, which had lots of room for analyzing the differences in health services and the state of people and governments.
Mm-hmm.
Came here in 1966. I started my job at Columbia the year after that.
So if we take the late 60s as the time when you had fully evolved to thinking of yourself as an epidemiologist, would you say is the biggest difference between epidemiology as it was practiced then 35 years ago and today?
Difficult. I think epidemiology, as I understood it, was very closely concerned with public health, and less concerned with the problems of clinicians in the wards. I can't remember doing anything or even thinking about what they now call evidence-based medicine or clinical trials for treatments. We were much more interested in the larger societal problems of prevention, interpretation and active prevention at the community level. And I think it involved an interest in what clinicians actually did in treatment, which afterwards became, I suppose, the power of epidemiology was to work directly with clinicians in clinical trials, which we had thought of clinical trials in the terms of the community level.
Okay. This may be an unfair question, but who would you say was the most influential in your development as an epidemiologist?
Well, I've mentioned Sidney Kirk, and in England it was Jerry Morris. Yeah. Jerry Morris's little book, I don't know if you know it, the first one, really put epidemiology exactly where we were. You had to be knowledgeable about the health of the country, and then you had to see these various problems, both treatment and prevention, in epidemiological terms, And the book is called Uses of Epidemiology. Mm-hmm. That was exactly the activist and yet scientific approach which we were trying to understand.
Interesting.
And we met Jerry himself on that occasion. We never worked with him, but we met him there, and he was really good to us, and it was really his influence that got Mervyn his first job.
Oh.
Because he thought that, I suppose he thought that what we were bringing to epidemiology would have a role in another university, which indeed it gave us the opportunity to work in Manchester.
Hmm. One of the features of epidemiology today, and I assume it has been for a while, is that collaboration is important. Can you talk about collaborations in your own career and what has made them successful?
Let me try, and that one's a hard one, but I'll try. I came here with a special knowledge, if you like, about mental retardation and mental illness, and so I had a natural contact with people in those fields, some of which were psychiatrists. But not only psychiatrists, also psychologists and educators were in those fields, and I learned from them quite a lot of problems and thinking about the problems. Didn't have as much contact as you might have thought I would with public health, although the New York City Department of Public mm-hmm. Health has always been very open mm-hmm. to thinking and working together. But I didn't myself make that journey downtown as often as I might have mm-hmm. in order to explore those problems. So probably I worked most in the fields of psychiatry and, as I say, education, mm-hmm. psychology. Mm-hmm. I also always worked with parents' groups in those fields mm-hmm. because you have to work where the problem is brought up. But I think that what really set us off into a research place in America was bringing together both our past experience, which was with malnutrition and poverty, mm-hmm. and mental retardation, which at that time was starting to be dominated by application of nutritional. Where does nutrition fit into mental retardation? And there had been a president's commission report, because the Kennedy set up a lot of emphasis on mental retardation. And the common phrase was, oh, it's all a matter of nutrition, which was very weird, because here we were talking about a country where there wasn't really yes. malnutrition. And there was a very interesting workshop took place the year we came, with people from all over the country, all over the world, discussing the role of nutrition and mental retardation. Well, Merle and I felt we know those two fields. We know starvation, we know nutrition from our work in South Africa, and we know mental retardation from our work in England. So we sort of moved into not believing much of what was written, mm-hmm. trying to come to grips with the biological laboratory work that was written then, and feeling that we should be able to make an impact on that area. And thinking that through brought us into the Dutch famine study. And that was wonderful for us, because it really enabled us to think a biological and social problem through and think of how an epidemiologist mm. could make a contribution there. I think that was the one we really first felt the power of epidemiology. Mm. I suppose were we to do that study today, we would have taken less direct approach. We would have been much more into epidemiological statistical sophistication, but it was the scale of a problem where you could be just a straight mm. logical thinking in epidemiology, make your design just to satisfy mm. that, and do it. And that's what happened to us. That study was really very good for our thinking.
Mm.
And study is
education.
And as a matter of fact, you know, I don't know if you keep in touch with that, but that study is still ongoing.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's still got implications.
Right.
It was so clever and there, mm-hmm. problems there. We also did another study at the same time with Dave Rush on putting intervention, an active intervention in nutrition in Harlem. And so we learned by those two studies in our first 5 years here, we'd thought through those and we'd had funding to pursue these two aspects mm-hmm. of epidemiology, mm-hmm. after which I think I never thought to go back into clinical medicine, because these were very absorbing and intellectually stimulating fields of work. And the next period of work, which you know very well, is when the geneticists started being able to mm-hmm. look at amniocentesis was introduced. Now, we were discussing earlier where the American Public Health Association went, and we used to go to those meetings, and I was quite eclectic in my activities there, and that's when I first heard a paper on somebody who did an amniocentesis and found the extra chromosome mm-hmm. in the amniotic fluid. Mm-hmm. Now, I had, because of our interest, I'm a bit discursive here, but it'll help you.
That's all right.
Because of our interest in mental retardation, we happened to attend, I think it was 1959 or 60, in London, the first international scientific study of mental retardation. Mm. Because mental retardation was a throwaway field, and it started coming into its own scientifically. And Lionel Penrose, who was the really big man of the field, he made a famous speech, and he said, in the future, people will look to mental retardation for answers to their biological problems. And within a few months of that, the extra chromosome was found. It was the first genetic chromosomal anomaly that was found. They didn't even have the number of chromosomes before that. And so I went from there with that kind of thing in my mind to this lecture at American Public Health Association of an obstetrician who took amniotic fluid and found the chromosomes and was able to predict that the child would be a Down syndrome. Mm. I just found that absolutely enormously interesting and intriguing. And so that started us off into the field of prenatal studies, which, as you mm-hmm. know, we pursued for a number of mm-hmm. years, and which mm-hmm. you pursued, and many of us are still thinking about. That was the growing point mm-hmm. For it. You couldn't mm-hmm. have done it if you hadn't learnt about the chromosomes, mm-hmm. and then if you hadn't moved to the amniocentesis.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, of course, into the social implications of what you'd learnt.
You raise a really interesting point, which is, what questions do we pursue? How do we pick the questions? It seems like that's one of the most important decisions an epidemiologist faces,
right.
And yet not everyone does it well. Can you reflect on that?
Well, just taking this little field of seeing the chromosome, which is the geneticist's contribution, the obstetrician's contribution of being able to look at it during the period when something might have been done about it, then there are social implications, which would include offering induced abortion. Mm-hmm. And then the next area, which we also were very much into, was seeing if this technique really works, then it should be available across the population. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in time, New York City set up an abortion clinic mm-hmm. for amniocentesis, which was for everyone who wanted it, which not only yielded a service, an important service, which would be made not only, as we used to say, to Princess Elizabeth in England, but would be available to anybody. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, and still, of course, the main risk factor was a woman's age.
Yes.
And a woman's age is known to her from the moment she mm-hmm. steps into the mm-hmm. prenatal clinic. And so there was a service you actually could institute, amniocentesis, judging your risk factor, and then, if appropriate, offering to terminate the pregnancy. Now, we were in that, and I think that took all the steps to understand sensitively and to carry through. And I think that was a very important level of thinking change as one went from the one to the other.
So it sounds like for you, a question has to have some biological content and
right.
public health impact.
I think I prefer that. I also like it to have some intellectual bite, because it makes it more interesting, more
mm-hmm.
fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it does with those beginnings and endings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think you went through a similar kind of type of yeah. challenge, I think.
Yeah. So what do you tell your students when they're looking for topics? How do you find those opportunities?
Well, it depends on what the student brings, really. We have a lot of students from developing countries, and I think that they bring problems from their own environment, and should. And I like to talk over with them where they see the need in their country. So we do start with that, and then move out from that. And mm-hmm. also their training, what they bring. I presume they bring motivation. They tend to bring motivation, and you have to keep the motivation going. You can't shove it off into analyses of things that happen in America that are purely methodological for the student. I don't like that. Many students do. It's a quick way to a degree, and that's their choice. But I don't enjoy those supervisions as much as I enjoy them when they have a meaning to the student, and where a student can use his or her background in a rather particular way to resolve it. Of course, some students bring no idea what they bring besides their mm-hmm. determination.
You've had a career in which public health impact was an important part of your satisfaction. And it seems that one of the difficulties for epidemiologists can be that in a given that we have a social conscience or oftentimes even an agenda of what we're looking
yes.
for, our data don't always support what we
right.
might.
Right.
Have you been in that situation?
Well, yes, in the famine study. See, the thinking in this country was that nutrition is very important to mental retardation. I remember there were court cases on this. For instance, a woman was advised by her doctor to eat mainly rice during pregnancy, and the child was born mentally retarded. So the case came before the courts. Is the doctor wrong? Did the diet lead to the baby's malformation? Of course, the jury awarded the family that, and as you know, those kind of things are happening all the time. But still, it's a reasonable question, that. And in the Dutch famine study, we didn't find support. We didn't find support for short-term starvation, famine starvation in a reasonably well-nourished population. 6 months of starvation did not make a difference to the intelligence. And one of our colleagues, many colleagues, were furious with us for that finding. Because it would have been much more satisfactory in terms of social justice to have found that food did matter. But in fact, nothing has happened since to change that opinion. What we have learned, as you know, is that certain nutrients, well, particularly, say, the folates or things like it, can make a difference in a detailed way, depending on the time and the place, to the outcome, but not a general starvation. And so far as we've looked at it, it was very comforting, because at that time there was a lot of civil war in Nigeria and starved children, and people were thinking that a whole Nigerian cohort would grow up mentally
damaged.
Retarded.
Yeah.
And we were happy to say we don't think that'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
So there was good in that, but there was bad in the people, many of our colleagues, aware of the social inequities, would like to have found a straight answer, given more food. It hasn't worked out like that. Definitely hasn't. On the other hand, I was always interested in iodine deficiency, and we did some studies on iodine deficiency, and as you know, iodine deficiency for the mother, early preconception, really, it results in various levels of cretinism or simply dullness mm-hmm. in the offspring. So that is, I think that's been very important. We did do some, I put one student onto doing that in Indonesia, which was very interesting.
But sometimes we have to be prepared for our data
for
not
wrong.
To support our prejudices.
Right.
Eh? Let me change gears here just for a minute and ask you one of those impossible to answer questions. But who would you regard as the most important epidemiologist during your lifetime?
Well, I would put Richard Doll. Richard Doll has got a genius for putting his finger on where the problems might be. Now, and he doesn't need high-powered, highly sophisticated statistics. He, I suppose, like me, if you like, employs hard thinking, understanding of the possibilities of the biology, choosing his colleagues very well, and coming to a reasonable answer. I think he has hit a lot of targets, and he is very motivated to use his data and use his position to emphasize a public message. And many of the public messages are very subtle and difficult, and he's thought through many of those, and he's still doing it.
Yes.
He's a very moral man, a very intelligent man, very thoughtful, and I think he's number one. And if you ask what he could teach you, I think it's more hard thinking and working with good colleagues.
And asking good questions, right?
And how does he get the questions?
Let me move the topic back to your own work. What would you pick out as your most influential paper?
Yeah, that's difficult. Not the famine study, because people didn't want to believe it, I think, although later people have picked it up and used it. So I wouldn't say that one. And with the using the Down syndrome, it got picked up by a lot of people, and now, you know, it's every day, really. Different techniques of getting it. I think Wild said recently that you should be able to diagnose a Down's before the end of the first trimester. In other words, you should use the radiology and the biochemistry to narrow down who's going to be a Down's. I think we were early on, though, in trying to think that through, although we didn't have the sophistication. And so I would say that. I think that my own personal thinking in the HIV field has been influential in focusing on women. I wouldn't like to say we've succeeded everywhere, but we have put that on the agenda, that women are particularly badly things. I think that Peter Piot said that gender is probably one of the main things in relation to HIV. Perhaps he put it better than I do with some such sentence, but at the time when I wrote a paper on that, we started thinking about HIV as for gay men, and we couldn't move from that onto other parts of the population, although we knew the epidemiology moved. We knew it here, we knew it in Europe, we knew it increasingly in Africa, but we still continue to think of it as a disease of men. And twice, my very fine colleague Robin Flam and I put in a proposal to work on women, and the project was turned down because women don't really get HIV. And I don't think it mattered. We both did other things, Robin and I. But when you look back on it now, it's absurd. Absolutely absurd. And in many ways, the family and the woman are at the center, the heart of disease, of the disease. So I think I'd probably be best remembered for that, because HIV has become such a worldwide phenomenon. And it's very widely understood by women and by others that women are I don't want to say the only, but women are the centerpiece of the epidemic. And how to handle that, preventive and care and treatment, every way.
Zena, you've been a woman in a field that was for decades dominated by men.
Yeah, I was thinking of that.
And you're talking about this contribution makes me wonder if, how much of that was due to your own perspective as a woman, and how do you see...
You know, I think I feel it more now than I did then. I mean, I felt it when I when I started thinking about HIV. But before that, my own experience clinically, I had a lot of experience with parents of mentally retarded children when we were in that field in England. But many of those, there were women and men, it was parents that I sort of identified with, I think, families and parents. And it wasn't until, and then in terms of reproduction, I didn't really have the woman so much in mind as you might think I should have. So I came more and more to feel that women were important as a topic in their own, I think, with the HIV field.
Going back to your own papers, would you single out any particular paper as one that you think has been really more valuable than people have realized?
That's a funny one, isn't it? That means that they could have used in their own field but didn't. Mm. It's hard because the funny thing is that when a paper's published, many times it's immediately used and it's not really long-term use. Other times you put a lot of effort and thinking into a paper and it's not used then and it's picked up many years later. Mm-hmm. I think, now your question is that it hasn't been used.
Well, maybe you could talk about the second example where one had a slow start and then gradually became more appreciated.
Right. Well, you know, in the work on the famine, the work in Holland, I suppose we must have done a lot of papers, and six or seven are important and interesting and useful, but people haven't taken them up. And sometimes, we were talking about this earlier, they went to special journals. And you might have a phrase which you and I don't like, they might have been buried in special journals. But like on the topic of intelligence, I was on an Institute of Medicine commission last year and the year before on young people and circumstances of young people in the home and out of the home. And the chairperson of that group was, her own field was IQ tests in the classroom and out. And she'd never heard of our work, which was a lot on intelligence. And I actually afterwards sent her some papers and she didn't acknowledge them. I don't believe she read them. And they were really what I used to call the epidemiology of intelligence. I went to Seattle one year, which we were talking about, and I offered them, they asked me to give a paper, the Department of Psychology, and which they knew from my papers, and I gave them a lecture called the Epidemiology of Intelligence. They were intrigued by it, and we had just shoved out these papers year after year. We had family size, birth order, rural, urban, number of, a lot of papers of importance, and they're hardly referred to, unless I refer them to, then somebody picks it up afterwards. Like a woman's age, we've talked about. Now we came to that from the Dutch famine study. We went into the special study, Lillian Belmont and I, about the age of the mother when the child was born, about having a sib if you were older or younger than the sib, if you had brothers or sisters who were older than you, all those things we investigated for fun and wrote papers about them in psychological journals, but nobody really thinks about them. It was useful. We had a useful way of bringing in young students too, graduate students into it.
What have been your own major interests outside of epidemiology itself?
Outside epidemiology? Well, I read a lot. And so I don't know if you could say that literature is an interest. It is an interest. But I don't read in a specialized way as some people do. I read a lot of novels, but I seem to concentrate on the 19th century. And I don't read as much of modern writing as I might. And I love the theater. And it's difficult to go as often as I'd like. I find it a great interest. But I don't think I find it an interest that it's a hobby, but it's not one obsessional hobby. It's too expensive. Travel, but it's not really it's an interesting hobby.
Can you reflect a little bit on what you think epidemiology has contributed to society in general?
Yes, I think it has contributed to public health, starting with the 19th century. There really was epidemiological thinking that made our drains, and it was, I suppose you could call the early bacteriologists epidemiologists, and certainly how they were used in the conquest of diseases, epidemiology. But also in Goldberger, I mean, not only the bacteriological emphasis, but also the nature of disease and then how it was followed up. I think that's been important in many conditions. I suppose most people, if I ask a young physician in this country, he will point to Framingham and the complete, much wider understanding we have of prevention of heart disease and hypertension. And that's been, of course, particularly important in the developed world. It hasn't really made an impact on poorer countries, but it doesn't matter. I don't mind where the impact is. And I think what Framingham did was really told our generation of medical students and young doctors that epidemiology can do something. They wouldn't have been nearly as excited by the elimination of pellagra, for instance. Or even of immunizing against infectious disease. They really understood what it meant to contribute to heart disease and hypertension. Mm-hmm. It somehow hit the imagination of medical students who become doctors, who are mm-hmm. important as a profession in sustaining epidemiology.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've had the experience for many years of telling your neighbors or your friends that you're an epidemiologist, and they have no idea what
have
that
no
is.
Idea. Until now.
Until now?
Yes.
So comment on that.
Right.
What's happened?
Well, you saw that, I wonder if you saw that famous New Yorker cartoon.
Yes.
And everybody laughs about that one. The word, it's still not, by the way, people still will confuse epidemiology with dermatology or something. Not everybody knows about that. Mm-hmm. But I think probably a mixture of the HIV epidemic, and now we've had the now we've had the recent post-World Trade Center epidemic, anthrax. I think these words and these concepts have made their way into the field.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it means that people understand epidemiology, but they do know they're epidemics. And that if you link the words, they know what you're talking about mm-hmm. to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that changes our opportunities in any way for there to be broader public awareness?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it also, young people have more of an idea of what they're getting into, and it's why it might be on the career map for young people when they see some of that mm-hmm. in the newspapers and mm-hmm. television, what epidemiologists can do. I don't think the anthrax epidemic helped much. If anything, somehow epidemiologists didn't really have enough of a public role in the anthrax epidemic. We'll probably discuss this at the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Not, maybe for political reasons. I don't know. But I think they didn't.
What would be your assessment of the current health of the field of epidemiology?
It's got a strong, I would say, in general, but it's got two problems. I mean, it's got many problems, and we do get wonderful applicants into the schools. There's no question about it. Wonderful young people want to take epidemiology. Some want to take it motivated by the sort of what it will do for society. Some because they see there's opportunities for travel and going to foreign climes and the power of it. But we do have wonderful students and applicants in the schools. So I think in that sense it's in a very good shape. My own looking at it reflection is I think that we don't always know where epidemiological methods and biostatistics, we don't know where the lines are drawn and should they be drawn. For instance, I think just in the last decade, biostatistics used to be very boring to medical students and outsiders, not to mathematicians, but to people in the health field. Now, biostatistics is seen as wonderful, and you've got to have a biostatistician on your right hand. And epidemiologists, we train them to be very good at biostatistics, at methods. And I think sometimes there's a conflict. Who do you need on your team, a biostatistician or an epidemiologist? Of course, I may say an epidemiologist, but many people will say, I need a biostatistics. I need somebody to chew the data. That's often said. You need somebody to put the data onto the computer and give me the answers. That's not what epidemiologists, they can do it, and many will take jobs like that, crunching, data crunching. They can do it, and they have to learn it, but it doesn't seem to me the particular quality the epidemiologist brings. I think the biostatistician doesn't need to know the problem very well. Epidemiologists got to understand the problem, got to think it through, is this the right way to go, and unless the epidemiologist asserts that particular strength in the discussions, he or she will be used as a rather lower-level data cruncher. And while a biostatistician might mind that, I don't think that's right. I think that we have to think through those roles and disciplines. And I don't think we should overdo the methods for the epidemiologist. I think they're important. The logic is more important to my mind than the sophisticated statistics.
Yeah, I see that as a theme running through all your comments. I think that's really an important message. What would you say are the biggest opportunities standing before the field right now?
Well, I think the world, and especially the developing world, has been overtaken by the two diseases of HIV and TB. I think that's an enormous challenge, and I like challenge. It won't take only epidemiologists to think it through or make an impact, but there is a very great area for epidemiology there. And I think working with collaborators, both clinicians and the lab side, and the molecular side, each of these has got a contribution. But I think the epidemiologist has an enormous contribution there, a major player. And they haven't really, in the past, epidemiology hasn't enough played as in that field. They've done modelling, and that was very exciting. Anderson and May and others modelled the disease. I felt that was interesting and intellectually fun, but not what's going to really make the difference, because a model is a model is a model. And I think we needed from the start more epidemiological thinking, which now we have, and the problems are enormous. So I'm not saying there are not lots of other problems, but for me, that's what the world's got to face at the moment.
I think some epidemiologists, especially the younger generation that's been trained with all of these methods and refined look at statistical and other methodologies, find it difficult to think about moving into an area in a developing country where your tools have to be rougher in order to get the job done.
Right. That's true, but then you have to keep at it. I think epidemiologists also need persistence. They need courage and persistence and energy, because the answers are not obvious and easy, but they have to contribute to the answers if they want to play a full role in it.
You've moved back and forth across this line between the developed world and the developing world.
Right.
Can you say anything about what you think would most help epidemiology in the developing world? What kind of how do you build an epidemiology?
Right. Well, there are lots of opportunities. In fact, there are lots of openings, and with training, I think experience in the developing world is essential, and because you've got to see what's there. I think you've got to experience and see. what you can do and what you can't do. You can move communities. You can work with communities. You know, you can do a survey and get 100% return, as you know, which you can't do here.
Yeah.
You don't pay your, you can't really pay your participants. Here you pay them $15, $30, $50, depending. On, and you'll still not get more than a 60% sometimes survey.
Mm-hmm.
It's different in a developing country. You've got to adapt your community, your strategies to what the community wants. You've got to spend a lot of time with the community. Epidemiologists got to do that as well, in the clinic, in the community. Something of that's got to come into the epidemiologist's experience, not just the computer. And I think here you can do more with the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's these difficult, these entry problems are not as difficult,
mm-hmm.
if you like, challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that makes it more fun to be challenged. And some of the skills you learn are not easily transferable. It's easy to learn a computer program and transfer it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so
mm-hmm.
easy to transfer the experience you gain. And I send students sometimes for a summer. People come and ask me, we're able to pay for summer electives. And they come back transformed, really. They come back with a whole different understanding of what can, what they can do and what they should do and what they can't do. And I think these are experiential factors which epidemiologists need, just like everybody else, for their trade.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice point that in some ways it's an opportunity to do better epidemiology in these
yes.
developing settings
yes.
than
right.
We might be able to do in New York City.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, of course, New York City's also got its places up
sure.
and down, and
sure.
I think you need that too. I don't like to take the experience out of epidemiology and replace it with computer programs,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a danger.
So what implications does that have for the kind of training that epidemiologists should have?
Yeah, that one is a difficult one, and probably you have the same thoughts as I do, because it does depend on what the candidate brings. A lot depends on that. You get the epidemiologists that come for training, or just like everybody else that comes for training, like anybody goes into medical school, they have to have some, they start with some feeling of where they want to go, and also what they're going to build on. I mean, some epidemiologists are doctors, MD, some are youngsters, just out of college, some are social science graduates with master's degrees. So they bring different things to it, and with their training they also bring different motivations. And I find they come for 2 years usually for a master's in our school, and I find they make up their minds and they do a lot of determining the direction depending on what they're exposed to. I think the background training is important also.
What about experience in the field, some kind of hands-on?
Yes, they must have that. They must have that. I mean, there are some people go to epidemiology because they're rather shy and not find themselves deficient in personal relations. As I say, we're all different. But I would like those scholars also to go and have some experience outside. I think I'd like the datum they work with to mean something in terms of where it's going to be used and how it's meaningful. It's a prejudice of mine. Not everybody believes that.
Well, that's okay. You're entitled to your own opinion at this stage. So the connection to the community is really that you're...
I think so. Any community,
yes.
but something. And I don't know what the community is. A community might be a hospital ward,
mm-hmm.
or it might be somewhere where they volunteered and they're doing their student days. A
mm-hmm.
community is a very general observation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would you say that the field of epidemiology is continuing to change in these last years?
Yeah, I think, well, as I mentioned to you, I think it's become more methodological. I don't want to put down methodology, but you know Sid Shapiro, he says, when we ask him whether the relative risk is important, he's got a joke like this. He says, well, if it's like that, it may be. But he says a chimpanzee can only tell you that, and that's important. And will make a big difference. This, he says, is really not important. And I suppose I'm somewhere in between. But I think when you find a very, very questionable, fragmentary relative risk, and you've done all the confounding, and it's probably not very important, And I suspect that Richard Doll thinks the same. In spite of his many findings, he also doesn't like a very narrow, you might say, victory for for your hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Another question which students often ask me, so I'm going to give you my question. I've got a young woman at the moment who asks me this all the time. Should they take medicine first before they take epidemiology? And it's a very difficult question, because I enjoyed my medical training, but then I didn't know there was such a thing as epidemiology when I started. But I don't know what medicine exactly gives you, because there are many things you need. You need math for epidemiology. You need maths, for instance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Somebody said, should I be a math major before an epidemiologist? I say, wonderful. Should I have been a molecular biologist?
Mm-hmm.
I say, wonderful. But when you say doctor, it means a lot of things. You, for instance, you'll have done 4 years when you've done a modicum of a lot of science, and you'll have been in the wards, and you've talked to patients, and you'll understand something about the hierarchy of nurses and doctors and the superintendent and how patients talk to each other. You learn a lot of experiential things. But when you've done your 4 years, you'll want to do at least 4 other years before you really want to do what you want to do. 8 years is a long time in this country from getting your BA before you go into epidemiology. Now, Mervyn was 5 years in the army, not by choice. I mean, by choice, but he wouldn't have chosen it before he went into medicine. These years seem very important when you're that age. They seem less important later on. Our class at medical school comprised newcomers, we used to call them kids, who came straight from school and did their 6 years, and the other half of the class had all been in the army, and sometimes 5 or 6 years, sometimes prisoners of war, everything. And we had 2 levels of classes, and we were all much the same by the time we got to the 4th or 5th year. We sort of merged. The age stopped mattering. It may have come later on. So you can handle quite a lot of years and not regret it afterwards and use it. And medicine is one of the ways you can do that. But it's not the only way. And I'm not sure whether the important thing it brings is the science, the natural science, or the arrogance of the doctor, or the patient-doctor situation, or all the other things I mentioned. I'm not sure which of those it brings, but none of them are absolutely essential to the epidemiologist. They're part of the experience, the varied experience that epidemiologists have.
So do you think you have to be over 30 to become an epidemiologist?
You mean to start training?
Yeah.
No, and at the school, as a school of public health, they used to only take you when you already had a BA, and like we were talking with Nigel, and I don't think that is essential. I think different people start knowing what they want earlier, and why not let them follow their bent? They know as well as we know about what they want to do, and they may change their mind, but they may not. You may keep a young epidemiologist interested and active in learning as much as you can keep one that came later in the field. And one reason why there are lots of women in the field is many women come to epidemiology post-family. We have some excellent people who didn't go, who married young, had children, and then saw epidemiology as their career. And some of them have been very, very good. Youth, what education is wasted on the young.
Yes, right. Well, it sounds like, are you saying that some experience in some areas is helpful to become an epidemiologist?
It is. Maybe it's helpful to mathematicians too, but I'm not a mathematician. I don't know that.
Well, you know, in mathematics, they say the best work is done when you're very young.
I know,
and that's maybe
right.
That's not quite.
And it may be the same, not the same with the epidemiologist. You may come later and catch up, as many do.
Do you have a sense that that some part of epidemiologic thinking is just inherent, that some people have the capacity and some don't?
I think so. I think curiosity is one of the qualities. Epidemiologists do ask questions. Like I have a colleague, and also another thing that they do, if they have diseases in their family, they like to ask questions about that, which is understandable. Something of which they have experience, like our presidents like to set up institutes if they have this, that, and the other. But people are like that, and they have seen things happen. and they ask themselves why, and could I make a contribution in that field?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think many things bring people into epidemiology. And now I think knowing about what the newspapers tell us about AIDS and TB in Africa, they come into that field because it's there for them.
And they feel they want to make an impact on
right.
that. You've touched on this, but let me ask the question straight out. What would be the single most important piece of advice that you would want to give to a student who is considering epidemiology as a career?
Try it.
Try it.
Well, I think so, really. Same as, for instance, many people go into social aspects of health, which I consider also a very interesting, important field. And some people are more drawn to that than to the quantitative demands of epidemiology. Not all of us are born quantitatively able to handle it, although I'm surprised about how many people come to epidemiology with no math, and well taught and conscientious, they master it very enough to be good epidemiologists, especially with machines these days.
Mm-hmm.
But some people, it's a choice to go into the health field and public health and make an impact between social aspects of health predominantly and quantitative or logical epidemiology. I value both those fields, and I think that you have to think through your own strengths and interests as to which way you go.
Well, Zena, we've run through these questions.
How are we doing?
I think we've got a fair amount of time left. I didn't keep track of my watch.
No.
But let me just give you a chance to bring up anything else that might be on your mind that you...
Right. Well, I suppose what I think is there are plenty of problems out there. It's not a field... I didn't mention that. I was just... When you asked me where the future is, the problems are there. There's no question. The problems are awesome, as the kids say. And I think that is a reason why people would go into epidemiology, and why I don't seem to find myself able to retire, which is another question, because there's so many new problems coming up or needing epidemiologists to resolve them or to make a contribution to them, even if not to resolve them. So I think it's no question in my mind it's got a future well beyond some of the diseases we're trying to the ways in which we're trying to prolong life and chronic diseases. I think epidemiology, to my way of thinking, has got more of a future, perhaps, than many other problems. And there are problems which will have an end point in improving the health and some of the social inequities of society.
Something that just crossed my mind, you've talked a fair amount about the dangers of becoming too absorbed with methods and
yes.
all these refinements of methods that we sometimes preoccupy ourselves with. Something we haven't really talked explicitly about is molecular genetics and how much that has come onto the scene and seems to be affecting thinking in all different areas of epidemiology.
Right, right. I think it's very important, interesting. It's funny, when Ezra went to medical school, I was sure he'd be drawn into that field because it was so much in my mind as a thing I would do had I had my way again to get educated at that level. But he wasn't, and it was surprising to me that he was interested in the fields he was interested in. It took me time to understand that. I think the area of molecular genetics and molecular biology generally
mm-hmm.
is enormously interesting and relevant to epidemiology. And I think there are many epidemiologists that try and master a piece of it. I have my colleague Louise Kuhn, for instance, who was a statistical major. No, she majored in psychology, and she has contributions in psychology. But she mastered, we discussed some of the factors in maternal infant transmission. We got the idea that there was a particular pathological mechanism that could be explored in that field, which she set about to learn and is still making a contribution to it, not only using the classical epidemiological issues, but the molecular also. And it's interesting to me how she's, with a non-biochemical background entirely, she's managed to absorb it and do it like you have and I have in the field of many aspects of genetics. It can be learnt enough to know where you're going, even if you're going to carry out the lab side of it. And I think the epidemiologists should have courage and learn what they need to about the end points they're after. They're not incomprehensible. Don't you sometimes wonder how much you know now in some of these fields compared to what you knew 10 years ago? And you have to read the articles and be challenged and understand what they're telling you.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the July 2003 issue of the journal.